This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Thousands gather in a southwestern Iranian city to mourn two victims of the recent terrorist attack in Shiraz. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah hails the recent maritime deal with Israel without normalization as a major victory. And the death toll from two car bomb attacks in Somalia rises to at least 100, with the terrorist group Al-Shabaab being blamed for the carnage. Thank you for joining us. And with our top story this hour, Iranians continue to mourn the victims of a recent terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. Right now in the city of Shiraz, crowds of people are gathering in a big procession to bid farewell to six of the victims. A similar procession is underway in the nearby city of Yosuj, the hometown of two other victims. Similarly, on Saturday, thousands of mourners took part in a funeral in the northeastern city of Mashhad. On Wednesday, a gunman went on a rampage in a shrine in Shiraz, killing 13 worshippers, including women and children. Over two dozen others have been wounded. The assailant was injured by security forces and later died of his wounds in hospital. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. Iranian officials have vowed to punish those involved. In order to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Mohammad Nasir Saghoyebiria. He is an Islamic scholar from Qom. Welcome to the program. Can you please tell us what do you think about the large crowds that have gathered in different cities across Iran, including Mashhad, Shiraz, and Yosuj today, mourning the loss of lives of their loved ones and also the victims of this terrorist attack?
One thing I want to mention, and that is whoever looks at this huge amount of people, number of people who come to the processions and the funerals of the martyrs, from the first day that this act started, it shows that the real voice of nation in Iran are these crowds, that they come to celebrate their victims, the martyrs. And this is a kind of vote for the Islamic Republic of Iran as well, and the government and the system. So the aim that the managers of these acts, they followed to divide the nation of Iran into two parts and start crashes between them, it is failed. These are pictures that shows the failure of the managers of this movement, although they have planned from before, and we can see the hands of the managers of these movements, how they coordinated everything, and they came forward to step by step come forward and divide the nation. The government and the Islamic Republic and the the ones who manage the Islamic Republic and the revolution, they have been very intellectual to see what are the goals of the enemy and how they can face these acts. And our people, as they have shown in the last 40 and few years after the revolution, how they are the ones who support the revolution, support the system, and actually they see the system as their own.
Mm-hmm.
These are pictures that show anybody who likes to see the truth, how people of Iran respond to these kind of plans against the nation of Islamic Republic and the ones who aimed the religion of people, they aimed the youth of these people, they aimed to the unity of these people to break it down, but they failed. And these are the beautiful pictures. Although we are very sorrow about the martyrs and the innocent people
in
the one of the holiest places in Iran, it is a very sad occasion, but our people, they follow the path of the infallible leaders that they have had from the beginning of Islam until now, and they have shown one more time to the arrogance of the world that they cannot be broken to pieces. They are one hand and they are behind their system. They are behind the benefit of their nation, and nobody in the world can break their unity. I think this is the clear message that this crowd is sending to the world.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you, Mr. Mohammad Nasser Saghoi Birya, an Islamic scholar and a researcher from Qom. Have a good day, sir. Moving on, the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, says both Israel and the U.S. were forced to accept a recently signed maritime deal with Lebanon.
It's very difficult politically, very difficult for their morale, it's difficult for their security, for their economy. And this was a humiliating issue for the Israelis that you have been since 2012, 2013, drilling, and you promised your people, you promised the people of this entity, and now there is a need, a global need or regional need, that you need this, and then you would annul Karish. They did not have that option. They could not have the ability to go to a war. They did not have the ability or the option to stop drilling in Karish, and therefore their only option was to go to indirect talks. Also, the Americans were under pressure as well.
Nasrallah hailed the maritime deal as a historic and major victory for Lebanon. The Hezbollah leader added that the U.S. was under pressure since their priority was the Ukraine war. He cited American officials who said they can't tolerate another war in the region. The Hezbollah chief said Americans lobbied to pressure everybody during the negotiations, but Lebanese officials stood fast on their stance. Nasrallah added that the maritime agreement was nothing or has nothing to do with the so-called normalization with the Tel Aviv regime. Israel and Lebanon officially approved an agreement on Thursday, laying out their maritime boundaries. The deal allows them to conduct offshore energy exploration from Karish gas field. We were earlier joined by anti-war activist Richard Becker in San Francisco to get his take on the maritime deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime. Let's take a listen.
Well, I don't think there could have been a deal without the participation and the role of Hezbollah as the what is really the strong organization in Lebanon. Certainly, you know, given the history of the expulsion of Israeli forces from the south of Lebanon, and in the 2007 war, was really a signal. Those were signals of how strong Hezbollah is and how strong it is relative to other forces in Lebanon, but also how strong it is in relation to Israel. And it's really the only movement that has been able to cause Israel to have to withdraw, to retreat in the way that it has. So I think that without the participation of Hezbollah, in all likelihood, Israel would have just taken what it wanted to, or would have imposed its own borders, regardless of the interests of Lebanon, in the Mediterranean and in relation to the gas fields there.
At least one Israeli settler has been killed and four others injured in a shooting attack in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. According to Israeli media, a Palestinian was among the four wounded. They claimed that the operation was carried out by a Palestinian attacker who was subsequently shot dead by Israeli forces. The Israeli army says it is conducting a sweep of the area for additional suspects. The latest operation comes as the occupied territories have seen a steep rise in shooting operations by Palestinians in recent weeks. The shooting also comes just days before Israel is to hold its fifth general elections in less than 4 years. Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad hailed the Al-Khalil operation. Hazem Ghassem, a Hamas spokesman, said the operation proves the resistance in the West Bank can surprise the occupation forces at any place. He added that the resistance bullets are a practical response to the Zionist regime's settlement expansion in the West Bank. Mona Candila, our correspondent in Ramallah, has given us more details on the shooting operation in Al-Khalil.
Well, what happened this night is that a Palestinian man arrived at the entrance, or at a checkpoint at the entrance of the illegal settlement of Kiryat Arba in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, and opened fire. There, clashes took place between the Israeli soldiers and this Palestinian man. He was shot and killed, according to the Israeli military, who named this Palestinian man as Muhammad Kamal Al-Jabari. And he was identified as a member of the armed wing, or the military wing, of Hamas movement. As you have mentioned, at least one Israeli settler was killed. Four others were wounded, including a Palestinian man who was identified as a paramedic who arrived at the scene in the Palestinian ambulance after there were news that Palestinians had been killed, or at least one Palestinian was shot by the Israeli forces.
To Somalia, where we now have an official estimate of the casualties of two car bomb attacks in the capital, Mogadishu. President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed says at least 100 people were killed and 300 injured. After visiting the site of the blast, Mohammed said the number of the victims could rise. So far, there's been no claim of responsibility. The president, however, is blaming the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group Al-Shabaab. The first of the explosions hit the education ministry near a busy junction. The second occurred as ambulances arrived and people were gathering to help the victims. The attack took place at the same place as Somalia's largest bombing, which killed more than 500 people 5 years ago. Al-Shabaab has been fighting in Somalia for more than a decade. It seeks to topple the government and establish its own rule. Abayomi Azikiwe is the editor of the Pan-African News Wire. He explains the motive behind the Mogadishu bomb attacks.
Obviously, the attack is designed to inflict terror on the civilian population in Mogadishu. 1 week ago, there was another attack in Kismayo, which is in the south. It's a port city with a lot of commercial activity. There was an attack on a hotel just 1 week ago. And this week also represents the fifth anniversary of an even larger attack that occurred in 2017. So the Al-Shabaab group, which has not officially claimed responsibility for this attack, it does follow the pattern of the organization. And obviously there's divisions within the group that was formerly known as Al-Shabaab, because if you look at the character of the attacks that occurred a week ago in comparison to what happened today, they seem to be directed towards different elements of the political elites and commercial elites in Somalia.
South Korea's president declares a period of national mourning after a Halloween crush in the capital Seoul leaves at least 151 people dead. Yoon Suk-yeol says the incident is a tragedy and disaster in the heart of Seoul that should have never happened. 19 foreigners are among the fatalities. They include nationals of Iran, China, and Norway. The toll is expected to rise. Scores of people have also been injured, some of them critically. The stampede took place as South Koreans marked their first Halloween in 3 years after the government lifted mask wearing and social distancing COVID restrictions. Hundreds of revelers packed into an already crowded alley. People at the top of the sloped alley fell over, resulting in the rush. Most of the dead are women in their 20s. Now moving on, Russia and Ukraine have carried out their latest exchange of prisoners of war, with both sides returning around 50 people. Ukrainian military officials have confirmed the return of 52 prisoners of war, including soldiers, border guards, and National Guard members. The Russian officials, for their part, said Ukraine had handed over 50 prisoners of war. The officials in Kiev say, more exchanges are being worked on. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia has freed a total of 1,031 prisoners since March. The head of the Donetsk region had said earlier on Saturday that a prisoner swap with Ukraine was taking place. Earlier this month, the two sides exchanged more than 100 prisoners of war in the first all-female swap deal since the war began in February. Russia accuses the United Kingdom of involvement in explosions on the Nord Stream gas pipes in the Black Sea.
According to available information, representatives of this unit of the British Navy took part in the planning, provision, and implementation of a terrorist attack in the Baltic Sea on September 26 this year, blowing up the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 gas pipelines.
The Defense Ministry spokesman also accused British Navy of helping Ukraine plan a drone attack on Russia's Black Sea fleet. The UK's Defense Ministry has rejected both claims that the British Navy was involved in attacks on Nord Stream and Russia's fleet. In late September, powerful explosions rocked the pipelines of the Nord Stream network, followed by massive leaks of fuel and unprecedented damage. Russia and several European countries called the incident sabotage. Moscow says Western countries didn't allow it to participate in international investigations of the explosions. The gas pipelines are at the center of an energy standoff between the West and Russia.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure.
from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has said Americans don't have a right to freedom from religion. The former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence made the remark on Fox Business Channel on Wednesday, 26th of October. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website, salon.com, has more on this story for us. Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence claimed during a Wednesday, 26th of October appearance on Fox Business Channel that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution does not protect Americans from having other people's faith forced upon them. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, it states. In fact, there are no references to a supreme being anywhere in the U.S. Constitution, because the Founding Fathers were adamantly opposed to centralized religious power, as well as requiring individuals to subscribe to any particular denomination. The concept of separation of church and state was sacrosanct to men like President Thomas Jefferson, who wrote in his 1776 Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom that setting up their own opinions and modes of thinking as the only true and infallible, and as such endeavoring to impose them on others, have established and maintained false religions over the greatest part of the world and through all time, and that to compel a man to furnish contributions to money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Thomas Jefferson's condemnation of false faith in the document was unambiguous, further affirming that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burthened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. The website of NBC News has more for us on the same story. Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said on Wednesday, 26th of October, on Fox Business Channel that the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution doesn't provide freedom from religion, the idea that people shouldn't have other people's religious beliefs forced on them. Host Larry Kudlow told Mike Pence that far-right progressives will not allow God into the conversation, will not allow religion into the conversation. Not just the conversation, the schools, the communities, the workplace. I mean, no one is allowed to talk about the Ten Commandments or the importance of moral values. People are allowed to talk about the Ten Commandments and morality in the United States. How can we have a truly great nation? These lefties want to scrap religion, Mike Pence, and I think it's a terrible mistake, host Larry Kudlow said. Mike Pence waited a bit and then responded by saying, well, the radical left believes that the freedom of religion is the freedom from religion, but it's nothing the American founders ever thought of or generations of Americans fought to defend. The good news is that after 4 years of the Trump-Pence administration, I'm confident that we have a pro-religious freedom majority on the Supreme Court of the United States. Despite Mike Pence's insistence, the First Amendment comes with two parts. He and Kudlow appear to be familiar with the Free Exercise Clause, which says Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. But there's also the Establishment Clause, which says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, the First Amendment gives people both freedom of and freedom from religion. America's founding fathers were opposed to the government forcing religion on people, especially considering the religious oppression and wars that have plagued Europe in the centuries leading up to the writing of the U.S. Constitution. No man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burthened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities, Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Constitution of Virginia, showing that freedom from religion was definitely something that the founding fathers were thinking of. Mike Pence's views on the establishment of a national religion could be of national importance in a few years' time. He has suggested that he's considering a 2024 presidential run, and as he noted in the interview with Larry Kudlow, the president can appoint judges who can rule against freedom from religion.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestinian land.
The deal of the century, the Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim will bring peace to the Middle East, but the Palestinians outright reject and say is an attack on their national identity as well as their land. I'm Robert Inlakesh, and I've come here to occupied Palestine to investigate what the so-called deal of the century means for the Palestinian people and the future of Palestine.
Following the official release of the controversial plan proposed to end the Palestine-Israel conflict, an escalation of violence ensued in occupied Palestine as Israeli occupation forces brutally attacked Palestinian demonstrators, only to strengthen the resolve of the Palestinian national resistance. Being on the ground in Palestine, I lived through this round of violence, witnessing vivid scenes of brutality, racist hate crimes, and the murder of Palestinians. But before we investigate this further, we have to first look at the past to understand how things got to where they are today. The peace process between Palestinians and Israelis, as it is often referred to, was officially initiated with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. When PLO leader Yasser Arafat signed the agreement with the Israelis, it was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state and the ending of hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis. However, a Palestinian state, as well as peace in the Middle East, never came. Instead, the Oslo Accords had meant for the newly established Palestinian Authority that they had accepted an exclusively Jewish ethno-state on 78% of their historic homeland and received nothing in return. 5 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was even more deeply entrenched as Israeli settlements expanded on Palestinian land. The only difference on the ground, as peace talks had been ongoing, was that there had been further theft of Palestinian West Bank resources, the besiegement of Gaza, and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. All of this whilst the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, had acted to protect Israeli security interests. Then, following the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, the illegal separation wall was later built in 2002, in the West Bank, usurping approximately 10% of the territory, also collectively punishing 150 Palestinian communities who were disconnected from their lands, according to the human rights group B'Tselem. Settlements continued expanding and the further confiscation of land and resources from Palestinians ensued, with illegal religious extremist Israeli settlers seizing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem as well as in the West Bank, all of this being justified by the Israeli claim the Palestinian terrorists had to be subdued and Israel's security had to be protected. Now, Donald Trump's self-proclaimed roadmap to peace would essentially allow for Israel to take half of the West Bank, annexing the most fertile agricultural lands, aquifers, and prohibiting Palestinians from having an army or any real autonomy. It would also connect Palestinian Bantustans together via underground tunnels. Upon arriving in occupied Palestine, I had traveled to the village of Kafin near Tulkarm, where an unarmed 19-year-old boy named Badr was shot in the neck and killed by Israeli occupation forces for protesting against the deal of the century. Unfortunately, this was not the last funeral that I attended of young people and children who had been murdered in the West Bank. However, they all resembled each other roughly. Palestinian family members grieving, the look of disbelief on a broken mother's face, and the cries from the village for a day where the martyrdom of their brother or sister will enable a free Jerusalem al-Quds, a belief that gives meaning to the life of those martyred. Al-Quds is at the heart of every Palestinian. It is holy to both Muslim and Christian Palestinians who are currently unable to visit if they live in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, or Palestinian diaspora. The international consensus for a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict states that East Jerusalem is to be the capital of the future Palestinian state. This, however, is not what is being allocated to the Palestinians under the Trump-Netanyahu vision. Instead, they are confining the capital of the Palestinian people to outside the separation walls of Jerusalem al-Quds.
I'm standing here in Abu Dis, the proposed capital for the Palestinian people. And of course, Abu Dis here is a suburb just outside of mainland Jerusalem, al-Quds. And what we see here in Abu Dis is the apartheid system in the West Bank at its most clearest. We see over here behind us Palestinian villages, Jerusalemites, separated from their brethren and their lands on the other side of the wall over here. People who have been separated so that they cannot see their family members, that they cannot come and farm their lands, and of course separated by this wall. If this was to be accepted as the capital of Palestine, that would mean not only would it be this little slither of land, which would not include the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, but it means that it will be a symbol of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And for them to live like this, seeing every single day what could have been, and Jerusalem al-Quds with Masjid al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rocks in the background, is utter pain and struggle.
This separation of Jerusalemite Muslims and Christians from Jerusalem al-Quds is rarely ever shown on mainstream Western television, and so before you travel to the West Bank, one would imagine that the situation is completely different from the reality faced here. What my cameraman and I witnessed on the Palestinian side of Israel's wall was the humiliation of Palestinians on a daily basis, and a space allocated for a capital which would hardly drive tourism to a country with its depressing scenery, bringing with it a feeling of walking around in an open-air prison. Even on the other side of the wall, Palestinian homes are constantly being demolished and stolen by Israeli settlers, as Donald Trump emboldens their actions with the decree that Israel's undivided capital is to be Jerusalem al-Quds. The justification given by Israel for such disturbing realities imposed on the ground is that what has been imposed is for Israel's security. But even if that was the truth behind the occupation and violations of international law, this excuse was not accepted internationally, by the court of public opinion when it came to apartheid South African whites. So why is it reasonable coming from Israeli Jews, I ask? But the issue of division isn't the only problem facing the Palestinians. There is also the problem of where the two divided peoples would live if remaining segregated, and where any viable borders could possibly exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. The issues of borders is of course made tough due to the Israeli illegal racial colonies, or settlements as they're referred to.
Something that you cannot escape when you come here to the West Bank is seeing and witnessing how deeply entrenched these settlements are into the Palestinian land here.
Currently, over 750,000 illegal Israeli settlers live on stolen Palestinian land, equating to a land grab of 40% of the West Bank. Due to seizure of land, Palestinians currently live in 165 disconnected islands surrounded by checkpoints, military outposts, closed military zones, and settlements. What is perhaps more disturbing, however, is the fact that one of the chief architects of what is supposed to be a peace deal, Jared Kushner, has direct ties to the funding of an illegal settlement named Beit El, with almost $100,000 that we know about. Kushner is also an open supporter of illegal settlements. Understanding that under Trump's so-called peace plan, settlements will remain in place, I traveled to occupied Al-Khalil, or Hebron as it's called, to meet with local human rights activist Issa Amro to learn more about what the situation would remain as in the heart of the illegal settler conflict zone.
Trump's plan is to make this permanent. Trump's plan is about, you know, legitimizing the settlements and legitimizing this apartheid and segregation and separation and keep me without any basic human rights. They don't want us to film their weakness and their truth. They don't want us to expose that Israel is an apartheid state, Israel is not a democracy, and Israel is not a state of law. It's the state of settlers, soldiers, and it's the state of apartheid and segregation. So the street is closed, all the shops are closed by military orders, and marked as closed shops. Look, it's marked, sealed, welded as a closed shop. It was closed first 1994 after the Ibrahim Awas massacre.
And what justification do they give? Why do they say they have to be closed? Do they give you a justification for closing it?
Always, always. The false justification is security. The main reason for it, it's about confiscation and to have the Arab free zone here. Closing the city center. It's the hub of the city, you know. It's the heart of the city. They closed it and they control it and they drive here. We are not allowed to drive. We're not allowed to drive in our own streets. Our shops are closed. Our houses became empty. They changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic name to Israeli Hebrew names. The road signs are only in English and Hebrew. Israeli flags here, they are taking our identity as Palestinian identity.
And this system right here with the shops closed and everything happening, under Trump's plan, this would remain closed?
It will remain closed. They didn't touch it. They didn't talk about it.
The main entrance to the family is closed. Yes. The main road is closed. And we are using the fields to reach the house here. And the family is separated and isolated alone. And the army is occupying the roof. They have a military post on the roof. The family is not allowed to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they are locked inside the house. And from time to time, the settlers come to the roof, throw stones, throw rocks, throw rubbish to the family without any help. Not only that, the Palestinian ambulance is not allowed to reach here without a special coordination. So you skip all the emergency cases. So you are not only sieged by the army and the soldiers, you are sieged from any kind of basic human rights.
We continued until we reached a military outpost where we were at first instructed at gunpoint to go back because Palestinians could not walk on the Jewish-only street there. So we filmed secretly as I asked the soldier present why Issa and my cameraman Hamdi were not able to walk on the road. The soldier I just engaged with refused to speak to me until I told him I was not a Palestinian, but many other soldiers had an even more negative attitude towards us, making it clear that Palestinians or any friends of Palestinians were not welcome. After witnessing the situation in El Khalil, I then traveled to Ramallah in order to take part in protests rejecting the deal of the century. At this protest you're seeing alone, tens of protesters were shot and many others gassed, causing them to collapse and convulse.
We have an attack here on a member of the press, clearly marked as press. It's of course a violation of international law, firing tear gas everywhere. He passed out unconscious. This man is marked as a press and of course is not protesting. He's here to document purely, and he was targeted by the Israelis.
After the demonstration, we found out following a visit to the Ramallah hospital that four young boys were shot with internationally banned bullets. Three were hit in the legs and one in the head. The protests I witnessed, however, were just the tip of the iceberg. Other demonstrations were much more violent and led to the deaths of several young Palestinians. To find out more about why Palestinian people broke out into mass protest against the deal of the century, I met with the world-renowned journalist Jana Jihad and Palestinian icon Ahed Tamimi, both locals to the village of Nabi Saleh.
So, since the announcement of the
first asking Jana what she had witnessed since the announcement of the Trump plan.
As you said, are getting killed, people are getting arrested. I'm facing checkpoints on my way to school every day. Like, for example, yesterday, I was just going to my school and then there was this checkpoint. You know, the checkpoints here in the West Bank are not checkpoints. They're just a gate on the street. They usually close it, block the street, and then they go. They don't check the car, they just block it. So, like, I had to take another way that takes me about triple the time to get to my school. I was late to my school. Even today, we were stuck for 2 hours on the checkpoint. Every day since the deal of the century had been declared, you know, people, there are a lot of clashes, people are getting killed, people are getting injured, and it's very sad that we are paying the price of something that we didn't cause.
What we heard from Donald Trump was that when this deal was initially announced, that there would be some sort of peace that would come out of this, and that the Palestinians would receive a great amount of money.
I believe that legalizing what's illegal is not peace. Legalizing occupation, legalizing settlements, it's not what we call peace. And I don't care about money. I just want my land. I want to stay in my house. I want to go to the sea that I've never been to, which is only 30 minutes far from my house, that I can literally see every single morning from the roof of my house that I've never been to. That's what I call peace, but that's not peace. And I don't care about money. What if I came and told you I want half of America, I'd pay you, but I just want half of America? Like, what would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
In Ramallah, I witnessed the largest demonstration the city had seen since the time of the Second Intifada, or uprising as it is known in English. What was clear to me in the West Bank was that there was a growing sense of desperation and also unity from the Palestinian people that could be felt building day by day. The desperation for action coming from the threat immediately posed to annex areas such as the Jordan Valley, which is where I began to travel to next.
So we've just entered the Jordan Valley here, and what we witnessed just as we were entering was the closed military zones here, and the soldiers in the fields actually aiming just above children and telling them to duck, using them sort of as firing practice. And then what we also discovered as we were driving along is that two Bedouin children, young children who were riding on donkeys, were also arrested by the army.
The Jordan Valley is home to 70,000 Palestinians, yet is 85% inaccessible to its people as Israel has turned the land into a military training ground and allowed for illegal settlers to come in and make goods to sell around the world. The area is under international law recognized as Palestinian land, which is to be the future agricultural hub of Palestine. Its undeveloped areas could also be used for energy projects water extraction, and urban centers.
One of the most important things to understand about the Jordan Valley is that this land here constitutes 30% of the West Bank, and of course means the loss of the most fertile agricultural land for a potential future Palestinian state. What you can see straight away when you come here to the Jordan Valley is that the people primarily here are building their houses as tents and as sort of cave structures and things like this, because the Israelis don't allow them here in Area C to actually build, have the permits to build homes. So if they were to actually build proper homes already before the land being annexed, and of course these people inevitably being expelled, then their homes would be bulldozed.
The conditions that have been imposed in the plan says that there is no Palestinian state. So what will happen with us? We are here more than 50% of the population. Now every year they demolish about 500 houses there. This plan says no Palestinian state and no sovereignty, no borders, no water, no air, no underground, nothing for the Palestinians. In Jordan Valley, we are 70,000 Palestinians, and and the Israeli settlers are only 8,000. So we have to stay, and our existence there will be the main factor to stop the century plan.
It was clear from even before U.S. President Donald Trump, alongside Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, announced the details of the plan, that the Israeli regime sought to annex the Jordan Valley, northern Dead Sea, and illegal settlements, throwing away all the progress of work done since 1988 between Palestinians and Israelis. Looking on at the situation on the ground in Palestine, it was clear that a two-state solution looked impossible, and that a one-state solution where Palestinians could live with equal rights to Israelis was a long way from coming to fruition. However, the younger generation of Palestinians served as a great source of hope that one day liberation could perhaps be in sight, and that the failure of the old is now being replaced by a new vision for peace coming from the young.
In the limelight.
European countries are very naive to believe that there could be a united front with Washington. Recent developments in Europe, including energy crisis as well as Ukraine crisis, show that Europe's submission to the US dictates has nothing for this continent except humiliation and suffering. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Global Times wrote, a Washington Post report recently entitled European Allies Worry US Could Dial Back Support for Ukraine said that U.S. allies in Europe are increasingly concerned that the united front of the West against Russia's operation in Ukraine could quickly unravel if Republicans are victorious in next month's midterm elections. According to a poll from Morning Consult released recently, only 29% of Republican respondents say they think Washington has a responsibility to assist Kiev. House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy warned on October 18th that Republicans will not write a blank check for Ukraine if they win back the House majority. Judging from the current situation, the Democrats will lose the majority of the House of Representatives. Lu Xiong, an expert on international relations at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, told the Global Times. Lu said that if the Republicans win a majority in the House of Representatives in the November 8 midterms, there will be an evident adjustment of Washington's policy toward Ukraine. And after the midterm election, U.S. aid to Ukraine will pare back or be heavily reduced. The frequent change in U.S. foreign policy is increasingly evident to the international community. The fundamental reason lies in the structural contradictions of the U.S. political system. The two parties represent different interest groups, and each election is essentially a change in the dominant interest group, noted Liu. Such a political system can sometimes work as a correction mechanism. However, with the relative decline of the U.S., all-round deep-rooted contradictions in fields such as the economy, politics, and cultural identity have been exposed, and it is difficult for the U.S. to devote sufficient resources to support its global hegemony, which makes it difficult for the U.S. to maintain a consistent foreign policy. Against the backdrop of the ongoing issues, the uncertainty and frequent change in U.S. foreign policy has brought huge policy risks to all European countries, as most of them tend to depend on the U.S. for security. As the Ukraine crisis remarkably impacts the security framework of Europe, it is normal to see European countries express concern over the U.S. potential move to reduce its support to Ukraine. The Ukraine crisis provoked by the United States has heavily undermined the European countries, with the Eurozone's inflation rate hitting a record high and the energy crisis getting worse. As winter is just around the corner, many European countries are now worrying about heating. If the U.S. remarkably cuts its aid to Ukraine, Europe will undoubtedly have to bear more. The U.S. has entrapped its allies or made them suffer heavy losses, especially European ones, many times. The rift between the U.S. and Europe and the U.S. crises of confidence among European countries have already been there. The U.S.-Europe divisions and disputes will become increasingly apparent due to U.S. policy inconsistency. After the midterm elections, if the U.S. does drastically cut support to Ukraine, it is believed that the rift will further widen and the crisis of the confidence will further deepen. Europe still needs to maintain independence and autonomy and cannot rely too much on the U.S. regime. Heavy reliance on the U.S. in policy means disaster for Europe. And independence will bring the possibility of a benign future for Europe. And as the U.S. continues its efforts to prolong the crisis in Eastern Europe, the European continent faces the grim prospect of deindustrialization and deep recession. The question that comes to mind is that why should European households pay for a conflict which is instigated by the U.S. regime? In this regard, Global Times wrote, deindustrialization, which has been hotly discussed in Europe recently, overshadows the efforts of Western developed countries to rebuild their industrialization. Deindustrialization is not new in Western countries. Since 1970s, industries in Europe and the U.S. have been moving out of their countries for comprehensive issues. But the newest wave of deindustrialization Europe is facing this time is largely influenced by a single effect, that is rising energy prices and imported inflation, further exposing all problems that already existed. Now electricity and gas prices have soared because of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. In an open letter to EU leaders, including Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, European Industry Association, Eurometo, raised the alarm about Europe's escalating energy crisis posing an existential threat to industry, calling on EU and member states and leaders to take emergency action to preserve their strategic electricity-intensive industries and prevent permanent job losses. Growing costs will cause a lack of industrial raw materials in Europe, including metals. Together with soaring energy prices, as well as the rise in import prices due to the devaluation of the euro, the decline of profit margins will bring troubles to both the enterprises and the broader manufacturing industry. As a result, the effects of Russia-Ukraine crisis are another burden on Europe's unresolved problem of past deindustrialization. Of course, decision-making